This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning and welcome to BFM 89.9's Morning Run. I'm Roshan Connison with Noel Lim in the studio this morning. And as usual, we've always got a great show lined up for you. But first of all, Noel, how are you doing this Wednesday morning?
I'm doing fine. It's Thaipusam Junior Day. Tomorrow's a public holiday.
Fantastic. Yes, Thaipusam is tomorrow. So wishing everyone a very happy Thaipusam Day and however you are celebrating, because I know it's going to be limited this year, right? You're not going to have the same procession as we've had every year. I think the FD minister and they've come to some agreement in terms of the numbers that can follow the procession. But it'll be interesting to see how tomorrow plays out. But now let's take a look at what we're talking about today, Noel. 6:30, we take a look around the world as we always do. Why don't you give us a little bit of guidance here? What are we talking about today?
Something of the US, the UK, India. That's all I can say.
Noel, that's not a lot of guidance. I'm a bit disappointed, but it's okay. And of course, towards the end of the hour, we always talk about the local papers and portals. But, you know, today on the grill, Noel, you're talking to, a Glomac Managing Director, Dato' Sri Fateh Iskandar. What are you going to be touching on in this interview?
Well, really about the property outlook, right? And I think we're going to start off the interview discussing about their mall, Glow Damansara, which is in Taman Tun, next to an MRT station, but it hasn't been doing well. I think occupancy rate is something like only 33%. It could very well be the least performing mall. So, and it is the biggest asset on their balance sheet. So I'm quite curious to know what their plans are for this mall.
Wow, I didn't know that, Noel. I didn't know it was the biggest asset on their balance sheet. And I've been to that mall. It's even before the pandemic, it was a bit of a ghost town, to use Dr. Sri Amime Maidin's words yesterday. You can catch that on our BFM app. We talked to him yesterday. But, of course, in and amongst all this, in about 10 minutes, we'll be taking a look at the situation down under. Google and Facebook are threatening to pull out the country after new laws in the country basically make it so that Facebook and Google have to pay news publishers for the news that on the website. But they're also saying that news isn't worth a lot. So there's an interesting thing we're going to dive into, but more importantly, kind of the sources where people get their information from today, right? We know social media is big, but how big is it? But before all of that, the big existential question that we all face in our lives, does money buy happiness? You can let us know on Twitter at BFM Radio or over on WhatsApp at 018-789-8899. To take you we're going into a few, we're going into a break right now. And with Valerie by Steve Winwood, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to BFM 89.9's Morning Run. I'm Roshan Connison with Noel Lim in the studio this morning. And that was Steve Winwood with Valerie off his their third studio album from 1982 called Talking Back to the Night. Now, we're talking back to you right now, and we're talking about Can Money Buy Happiness? And Noel, this was an article you shared with me, and it's very, very interesting because they're citing a new study that basically differs from the Daniel Kahneman study of 2010, which basically said that after a certain point of income, I think the bracket was $75,000 to $90,000, life experience or basically happiness started a downtrend, even though your evaluation of your life in general, satisfaction, continued to go up. This new study, which uses app data essentially with more data points, says that that isn't necessarily true, and that in fact, money does buy more happiness. I'm making a very simplistic point here, but that's essentially the long story short.
Yeah, so Daniel Kahneman, Nobel Prize winner, psychologist and economist, he did his earlier study where he measures happiness based on emotional well-being that increases as income increases but plateaus after $90,000. That was his study. And of course, this $90,000 really depends on which state and all that, right? The sample is made. And then this other study that you just mentioned, I think it says that life satisfaction continues to go up as your income rises. But I noticed that if you look at the chart, the emotional well-being drops off post $625,000 income. So that's quite interesting for me. But I will just speak for myself. I find myself feeling much more secure, feeling better about myself once I pass that certain monthly income. And I would say, I think for a lot of people, it's that five figure, right? You feel a lot more better about yourself, I think just financially, and you feel like you can, afford a bit more luxuries.
Yeah, I guess it really is down to that security need, right? Again, again, I like citing the Maslow's hierarchy of needs because I think it encapsulates life quite well. At the very base of it is your physical and security needs. And if you haven't taken care of that, or you don't feel like you've taken care of that, then the rest of it really doesn't matter as much. Things like self-actualization or caring about the environment, things like that, those seem like less of a priority when you can't, when you feel like you can't take care of yourself. Now, I do want to say that in the Daniel Kahneman study, they did note that no single article can settle this complex question of whether money buys happiness, right? And they used Gallup data back in the day. 10-12 years later, they've got this other study has more data developed from the app. So it's an interesting observation, but I guess it really does come down. I find again, from a personal experience, I think this is from the last 12 months. It's been a very volatile year, right? This time last year, we were starting to learn about, I think it was the first time a case of COVID-19 was detected in Malaysia that was imported back then. And then in March, we saw the lockdowns. And for the first time in my working career, I felt an insecurity about my job, right? Because it's not just me, it's many people. Many people lost their jobs. Many people got pay cuts. Many people basically had their livelihoods turned upside down. And what I did was I made sure that I had 6 to 12 months of backup money. And that meant taking some money from elsewhere that I had prioritized for other assets and things like that. But the happiness, or at least the calm and security that emergency buffer fund, as one of my guests, Rajan Devadasan, likes to talk about and call it, it gives you a sense of security. And then it allows you to feel better about generally a lot of things, right? I found that with that buffer fund, even my investing, I wasn't as worried anymore because, you know, I understand, academically, I understand that investing is for the long term and things like that. But, you know, in March last year, when portfolios fell through the floor, it's very hard not to get scared or anxious about it. That buffer fund does really help in that situation.
Yeah, you know, with that buffer, you can either, if you lose your job, you have something to tide you over, or you have the extra to even go in and buy stocks at a fire sale, right? But I think money is always definitely going to be helpful because mm-hmm. you have access to better healthcare. And you can eat better. And also another aspect, apart from money, I think it's just good relationships, right? Working in a place where you enjoy working with your colleagues, having good relationships with your friends and family. I think all that is still quite crucial. But it's also what happens, you know, to ourselves psychologically, right? So there's this study by Richard Davidson, University of Wisconsin Medicine. He says that a wandering mind is an unhappy one. So he has done a lot of neuroscience tests and all that, scanning people's brains. And you find that a brain that wanders a lot tend to be unhappy. I think that's because you are thinking a lot, thinking about the past, thinking about the future, thinking about yourself, thinking about other people. You know, it's all this thinking can trigger a whole range of emotions and that can bring you down to a spiral. So he says, you know, learning about attention, cultivating focus, all that can really help.
That is very interesting, Noel. I think too much wandering, right? I think this also goes to the old phrase of an idle mind is the devil's workshop. That those sort of things, basically, I guess when you don't have a purpose, that can also affect your situation. And when you don't have, I think, a concentrated effort in your life, because a lot of times, I think many of us get our satisfaction from the work we do, or at least in the pursuit of money, right? Seeing the bank balance or the wages go up. Those are also metrics of success and progression and things like that. But, you know, when we talk about the experienced well-being and the life satisfaction, it really does feel like it after a certain point of income, then maybe isn't the improvement or the scale isn't as steep anymore, right? Yes, more money can buy you more happiness as you go forward because you get more things and more security, and maybe you get to enjoy more worldly pleasures and things like that. But it's really that gap, right? Because if you look at, I think, Kahneman's data, it was up to like $75,000 to $85,000 a year, dollars, that people really were experiencing both negative life satisfaction and negative experiences. But after that, you started seeing positive on both sides. And yes, they grew after that. But I think I think we like to tell ourselves there's only so much money we can earn. But I think in the long run, money does really does buy happiness, Noel.
I'm sure at least 40%.
You know, but that's just me and Noel and Daniel Kahneman talking here. Why don't you let us know what you think when it comes to money and happiness? You can reach out to us at BFM Radio at BFM on Twitter at BFM Radio or over WhatsApp at 018-789-8899. We're heading into a few messages right now. When we come back, we'll talk about where you get your news from. Is it your social media feed? Let us know on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, welcome back to The Morning Run. I'm Roshan Kanasin with Noel Lim in the studio this morning. And that was Mad About You by Belgian band Hooverphonic, a lead single from their third studio album, The Magnificent Tree, back in 2000. Wow, 21 years ago. Anyway, that piece of trivia right there was brought to you by the powers of my fingers typing on my keyboard, pulling up Google and ending up at Wikipedia, showing you the power of Google search, right? And that's exactly what we're talking about today. How much news and information do you get from Google and Facebook when it comes down at the end of the day?
So this news that's been really, I think, gripping Australia, if I may say, executives from Google and Facebook have told a Senate committee they are prepared to take drastic action if Australia's news media bargaining code, which will force these internet giants to pay news publishers for linking to their sites, if that code comes into force. So, you know, when I look at this article, right, by The Conversation, I cannot help but think, who really will be the loser from doing this, right? Mm-hmm. From compelling these giants like Google and Facebook to pay the news publishers. I cannot help but think, actually, it might be the news publishers that will lose out money. But I have to put a small disclaimer here. I have a tiny stake in Facebook.
A tiny stake in Facebook, Noel? So you're totally not biased there or anything, huh?
No, of course not.
So this news came out because the Australian government is looking at ways to, more specifically, the Australian Parliament is looking at this news code that would make basically Google and Facebook have to pay for links. Google said it would be unviable for them to continue business in Australia, Google search in Australia, if that was the case, which could lock out 90 million Australians from using Google every month and 17 million people who log on to Facebook. And for Facebook specifically, I think it's the news feed. And this is a bit of an interesting situation. It's something publishers and social media have been fighting out for years. And in a year where big tech, the spotlight on big tech is just getting bigger and bigger, we've got antitrust regulations coming up in the US. We've got concerns over Apple's App Store dominance. We've got concerns over Facebook and Google when it comes to digital advertising. Who's the other big tech players? I seem to be forgetting a few of the big names here. Amazon's dominance when it comes to e-commerce, right? And in fact, go across the world to China, same thing. Alibaba, Tencent, all under the microscope in their respective governments and the countries that they operate because of the sheer magnitude of their business and their influence. And I think something like this, yes, Google said it in a very professional, lawyerly way, the way they would, it'll be unviable for us to continue business in Australia if this is the case. But what it is it's a threat. It's a threat, underlying threat to the Australian government. And and I have to read this statement from Scott Morrison, the Prime Minister of Australia. Let me be clear. Australia makes our rules for things you can do in Australia. That's done in our parliament. It's done by our government. And that's how things work here in Australia. And people who want to work with that in Australia, you're very welcome. But we don't respond to threats. I have to say it's a very powerful statement coming from the Prime Minister. What actually happens after this is anyone's guess. Will Australia stick by this content code thing and get money? Because Facebook has noted that they are working directly with publishers to sign deals to pay for content. So I think they've signed around 450 deals with media companies around the world.
Yeah, so
450 is not a lot when you think about the global scale.
Yeah, so I guess the Australian government has to take a tough stance. That's their approach. And I suspect maybe a compromise may be reached. I think, you know, it's fair to say media companies do rely on Facebook and all these social media platforms to get their content viralized. And they can actually control to some extent what content is put up on Facebook from their side. But of course, users may be sharing their news, right, on their own personal feeds. So I think media companies rely a lot on Facebook. That's just become the ecosystem. At the same time, Facebook needs content. Yeah, because users go online.
Exactly.
They don't just want to hook up with friends and know what's going on with their friends' lives. They also want to see some, read some news. So it almost feels like they both, both parties have to figure out how to work together in a mutually beneficial way.
Yeah, so Facebook claims that news is of little real value to its business and it doesn't make money from news directly, and claims that from an average Australian user that 5% of the news feed is made up of news. Now, the key word here is making money from news directly, because I would argue and say that news is a key component of Facebook's value proposition, right? The idea of getting onto this platform and being updated, whether it's personal, current affairs, business, whatever, but basically it's supposed to feed me information that I find relevant. And this specifically to Australia, in 2020, the University of Canberra had a report, a digital news report that found that 52% of Australians get news via social media, and that number is growing. So it's a bit of optic management, right? Say, oh no, we don't directly get money from news. But what is the value that news provides to your business platform?
Yes, and absolutely. Because the news that you know I read, your algorithms will know what sort of ads to push to me, right? So,
exactly.
So yeah. But I mean, having said that, I think then it also comes down to the question, the value of news, right? Do people really check the news every day? I mean, we do because it's our profession. But actually, you know, the average Joe, do they really check the news every day, except for maybe when there's a crisis, when people want to know, okay, what's the number of COVID-19 cases or which politician is resigning? But other than that, they just get on with their lives, and 6 months later, they find, oh, my life has not changed. You know, I haven't read the news every day.
Yeah, but I think it's just a soft value proposition, right? It's there, and I think it plays an important role in the allure of social media. But that said, Noel, I completely agree, because I mean, I've never watched so much CNN as I did during the US election, really. And yes, I'm a broadcaster, and this is our job, but my father and mother have never watched that much CNN since, I think, the last election. We were glued to our TVs. CNN was on in my house for 72 hours.
So do you influence them, or is it because Trump is such an interesting personality?
Oh, it's just because of the how close the race was, right? And everyone just wanted to know the numbers. It was really about how close the race was. I think it came down to that. And people were trying to understand the factors at play and how it worked out. So I actually personally like going to the websites themselves, right? So I like going to Bloomberg, I like going to CNBC directly and then getting the news there. And then you'd realize that this is how news portals make their money when it comes online, right? Like if you pick up a newspaper, you're not fighting with other publishers for advertising for your eyes. So when you're on Facebook, that's a whole different ballgame, because you're fighting with so much other information there. So I'd be very curious to see how the Australian government proceeds with this content, with this code thing, and how that comes back to the news publishers.
Yeah. So very quickly, the Australian government, in pursuing this path, it seems like it will benefit Australian news companies because you get paid. But I wonder what it really means for the users. I mean, are the users going to ultimately benefit from this move?
Exactly. And you can let us know how you get your news over on Twitter, ironically, at BFM Radio, and on WhatsApp, 018-789-8899. And let us know. We'll try and read out your messages in just a little bit. Right now, we're going into a few messages, and then we've got the 6:30 a.m. news. To take you there, we've got Cottonmouth by the Doobie Brothers. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. Morning, and that was the XX with Islands. And now let's talk about what's happening around the world. And we're starting over in the U.S. because right now, I think there's the vote going on for whether they should try President Trump, right? So a majority of Republicans have rallied against trying former President Donald J. Trump for an incitement of insurrection, with only 5 members of his party joining Democrats in voting to go forward. So the vote came down to a 55-45 vote. Very narrow, if you really think about it, because about 5 Republicans did jump over. And just to remind everyone, the Senate split right now is 50-50, with Vice President Kamala Harris as the tiebreaker in any vote there. So this is it will go through, but what the Republicans were trying to do was trying to make it, there was a decision, a vote about whether it was unconstitutional to impeach a former president.
Yeah, so what I understand here now, the trial on Trump's impeachment will begin as scheduled in the week of February 8th. And yet the support I know of the 45 Republicans for declaring this trial invalid indicates that there are long odds for Trump's conviction as the discussions continue to proceed.
Yeah, and actually, as we're talking right now, I think about half an hour ago, some news came out that, if I can quickly just find this again, yes. So it's the Biden administration has faced its first blow, and this is to its immigration agenda, as a federal judge blocks a 100-day pause on deportations. So the U.S. District Court for Southern District of Texas on Tuesday issued a 14-day nationwide temporary restraining order sought by the state's attorney general that would prevent carrying out the policy, which was issued by Homeland Security Departments within hours of President Biden's inauguration. The order will remain in effect until the judge has considered a broader motion for a preliminary injunction. And this does bring back memories of when President Trump was first brought into office, right? Because there were some executive orders that were signed that people were not particularly pleased with, and you had federal court judges coming in to stop the motions because there were cases filed in court. So now you're seeing a similar situation, and this time from the Southern District of Texas. It'll be interesting to see what else gets challenged, because as we noted earlier this week, President Biden signed a lot of executive orders, and a lot of them do reverse some of the policy decisions that the Trump agenda had during their administration.
Yeah, I think all this just reflects the vibrancy of the U.S.'s institutions, right? Where, you know, a president can sign an executive order, but somewhere down the line, a state, for example, can push back. So I think it just reflects how lively and how robust their discussions can be. But oftentimes, some of these discussions could be hijacked by political interests. But well, hopefully good sense will prevail. And I think also we learn from history, when a new president comes in, when a new leader comes in, there's always this high hopes for this new leader. I think we just have to be, you know, quite pragmatic these days, right? We cannot expect the sun and the moon from anyone, even though if they mean well, you know, a lot of times their agenda can be hijacked.
Yeah. And just very quickly, just going back to the impeachment trial here. So I think with the 45-55, the Republicans are looking, some Republicans have declared victory, because it takes more than a simple majority to impeach a president, or a former president in this case, because I think you need like a 2/3 or at least a 60-vote margin to get that through. So where are the Democrats going to get 5 more allies, right? So right now, the Republicans who have joined the Democrats on this vote here were Senators Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, Susan Collins of Maine, Mitt Romney of Utah, Van Sass of Nebraska, and Patrick Toomey of Pennsylvania. And all 5 had previously said they were open to hearing the impeachment case. Any more Republicans going to cross the line? We'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, I think Democrats will obviously have an incentive to push forward for this, because it really puts their reputation on the line, right? Because, you know, they need to strike that balance between, promising to hold Trump accountable at the same time, you know, delivering their new priorities.
Yeah, but on that note, how much time do they want to spend on this, right? Because Biden has a lot of other things on his agenda. But now let's cross over to the UK. Noel, because they've crossed a bit of a sad landmark or milestone here, as they see 100,000 deaths, COVID-related deaths. And Boris Johnson has noted that he says he's taking full responsibility for the government's action, saying we truly did everything we could, and he's deeply sorry for every life lost. I think that the tally stands at this. It crossed the number after 1,631 deaths within 28 days of a positive test were recorded in daily figures. That's how the metrics are put together. So the total is 100,162 deaths recorded in the UK.
Yeah, it is really, really sad in the UK. And, you know, it's just so unfortunate. And the thing is, right, the UK is the 5th country to pass 100,000 number of deaths, coming after the US, Brazil, India, and Mexico. Now, US, Brazil, India, Mexico, these are countries with huge population, right? Mexico alone has 128 million people. The UK only has 67 million people. So it seems like, you know, maybe the government could have done a better job on stepping up on, you know, trying to curb COVID-19. And it doesn't help now with that new variant in circulation.
It truly is a terrible milestone for any country to hit. And I think they're the first in the European region to do that. But, you know, if you have any news, anything, any thoughts on any of the things we've talked about, you can reach out to us over on Twitter at BFM Radio or on WhatsApp at 018-789-8899. We're going into a few messages right now. When we come back, a look at the local papers and portals. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. Welcome back to The Morning Run. I'm Roshan Kanesan with Noel Lim in the studio this morning. And that was The Other Side by Aerosmith, so eloquently asking us to take us to the other side of this pandemic. And right now, we're taking a look at the local papers and portals. Noel, you've got the NST in front of you. What's on the front page?
Yeah, so the NST continues to put a spotlight on the plight of, the B40 community who have to get online and study. And now they are looking at some Orang Asli community. I guess it's a very difficult situation for them. I mean, when you face the situation of patchy internet, for example. And so here, there's a story here where a group of students have to eke out at a pond dock in an oil palm small holding. And interestingly, they have a good internet connectivity in that area. And there's some pictures here, kids sitting on a mat or a rug doing their lessons. I guess these are like some pond dock schools that have cropped up. And also, there's some updates from the Higher Education Ministry. They are in the process of acquiring something like 4,000 laptops and desktops to be distributed to university students from the B40 income group, and they are in talks with Bank Simpanan National to roll out some loan initiatives to also help students with their purchases.
Yeah, I've got the Malaysian, and that's something we've talked about, right? I think yesterday we talked about this. Earlier this week on Monday, we talked about the state of education with Advolution Melissa Gomez. And essentially, it's a challenging time right now. And I have seen groups of people fundraising. I think we saw Syed Sadiq and Muda fundraise. I think, I can't remember how much money, but they managed to buy
over
laptops.
Over 100,000, really?
Yeah, it was a substantial amount of money that they fundraised. And excuse me. And they distributed to the laptops to kids in schools. So we're starting to see these actions. But I guess the big question is it enough? Because, I mean, the government is trying to do to provide the equipment. But at the same time, how much money can the government spend on these things, right? Because everyone is asking for the government support during this time. And we all do have to note that government revenues are on a little bit of a pressure. The tax revenue is we're expecting lower corporate taxes on the back of, except for the rubber gloves. Generally, the corporate scene, the businesses haven't done well. Don't forget that, oil prices have recovered a little bit. And I think our budget was based on an oil price of $40 to $43. I think I can't remember the exact number right now. So maybe pressures may be able to surprise on the upside with oil prices at $55 a barrel, but it's not something we should take for granted. I've got the Malaysian Reserve in front of me, and they've gone with EPF may do better than ASB when it comes to dividend payout on the front page. So next month, I think the end of next month, we should see the typically based on past patterns when EPF declares its dividend payout. And sources told the Malaysian Reserve apparently that EPF is considering a dividend payout of between 5% and 6% for 2020, which apparently will beat the Amana Saham's PNB's Amana Saham Bumi Putra for in terms of return for the first time. And this is based on the fact that I think unlike PNB, EPF's assets are mostly in bonds and also overseas. This is based on the source that spoke to the Malaysian Reserve. So if we take a look at the last 18 years, the highest dividend rates from EPF was I think the 6.9% in 2017. And before that, it was the 6.75% in 2014. I know a lot of people were definitely pleasantly surprised in 2017 when that 6.9% was declared.
So back to something about the COVID-19 and the MCO. So, early in the week, most of us might have been spooked by that memo that was issued by the European Chamber to its members about the possibility of a full lockdown after February 4th. So Dato' Sri Ismail Sabri Yaakob has come out to say that, to talk about this possible lockdown. He said that it might not be imposed after 4th of February due to its adverse impact on the economy and people. He said that 2.5 million people might lose their jobs, while another 2.5 million people would have had their livelihoods affected, which will make it very tough for them to survive during this pandemic. And obviously, the B40 group will continue to suffer even more.
Yeah, this job loss thing is very, very concerning, right? Because on the front page of the Malaysian Reserve as well, they spoke to the Malaysian Association of Hotel Owners, the ED, Sharuddin Mohammad Syed, who said that more hotels are expected to close down, right? Because during this time, they've had a tough year and the MCO really has killed tourism at this juncture because you can't do interstate travel, which was the one saving grace. And while I understand the rationale for the MCO 2.0, it doesn't change the reality on the ground that there is going to be economic scarring from this, right? I think just last week, or was it earlier this week, they announced the release of 11,000 inmates who for crimes there, for minor crimes. This is another 11,000 people who are going to go into looking for jobs, right? And the day, this is the market, and this is something that the government is going to really, this is the long-term impact that we need to pay attention to.
And still about vaccines, Dua Pharma, they've signed, they're going to procure and supply to the health ministry the Russian vaccine. So some interesting developments there. So I guess it will complement the portfolio of vaccines that the ministry will be purchasing.
And opposition leader Dato Sri Anwar Ibrahim has filed a suit to challenge the validity of the Prime Minister's advice to suspend Parliament during an emergency. So we'll be covering that as we go on, as developments ensue on that part. Right now, we're going into a few messages and then the 7 a.m. news bulletin. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.